Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Thanks, folks. Thank you. Lars, thanks very much. And I'd like to say you're the best looking and most intelligent member of your family, but I'd be lying if I said that. Well, I know Stephanie's not here, that's why I can say it. Well, good morning to everyone. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning, and I consider this a very important opportunity to visit with you, and an important day, and an important topic. And so bear with me as I talk a little bit about the crop report this morning, the drought and our reaction to the drought, the philosophy that this administration has adopted in terms of rural development and agricultural policy, the importance of the biofuel industry, in my view, and a discussion about the RFS. So it may take a little time to get through all that, but hopefully you'll bear with me. So this morning we did have the August crop report, which is the first survey, if you will, of what we see on the ground in terms of production. And obviously it comes as no surprise. The drought has impacted and affected corn and soybean production in particular. The report came out that the overall estimated production for corn for this crop year, 10.8 billion bushels. That averages about 123 bushels to the acre, and obviously that's down from what we had anticipated at the beginning of this crop year. Fortunately, we planted nearly 5 million additional acres of corn. So as a result of this, even with the drought, even with the challenges, even with the difficulties, we're looking at the eighth largest corn crop in the history of this country. And that it speaks volumes as to the resilience of the American producer and its willingness and their willingness to adopt new technologies that make it just a little bit easier to get through a very, very tough period. We know that as a result of this, the market is already responding and reacting. We anticipate that livestock use, corn, will be down from just 2 months ago, about 725 million bushels. We expect exports to be down 600 million bushels from what we projected just 2 months ago. And ethanol production and ethanol use also down roughly 500 million bushels from what we anticipated and expected just 2 months ago. On the soybean side, we're looking at a crop of roughly 2.69 billion bushels, an average yield of about 36, a little over 36 billion bushels, or excuse me, 36 bushels per acre. Domestic crush will be down from our initial estimates of a couple months ago by about 95 million bushels, and exports we expect to be down quite a bit as we anticipate some competition from South America, 260 million bushels. Obviously, these numbers will have an impact and are having an impact on livestock exports and on fuel production. My heart goes out to every single producer who's impacted and affected by this drought. As I explained the other day to a reporter who was trying to ask me, how do I feel about this and what's my reaction to it? I said, you know, it's not about my reaction. It's about the fact that there are people who go out at the beginning of the crop year and do everything right. They make every decision perfectly. They have the right seed. They plant it at the right time. They do everything absolutely perfectly. You know, in the Olympics, when you do that, you're rewarded with a gold medal. But Mother Nature plays tricks, and the reality is that even if you do everything right, you're still faced with potentially a loss of your entire crop. And that's the difficulty and challenge of agriculture. But it speaks volumes to me that we are dealing with the eighth largest corn crop in our nation's history, notwithstanding the drought. And it is amazing to me as I speak to producers, as I travel around the country, as I'm in fields seeing the damage, there's this quiet confidence of American agriculture's ability to withstand and deal with difficulty. You're an amazing group of people, often underappreciated, and certainly not recognized for the contribution you make to this country. And sometimes tough times give us an opportunity to remind the rest of the country how difficult agriculture is and how important it is. My heart really goes out to those livestock producers and specialty crop producers who don't have the benefit of some of the risk management tools that some of our crop producers have. In 1988, the last time we faced a serious drought, 25% of our crop producers had crop insurance. So it was devastating for that other 75%. Today, 85% of corn growers and soybean growers have crop insurance. So it's a little bit easier to get through a tough time because of that risk management tool. But our livestock guys and our specialty crop guys don't have that. And that's why it was important in 2008 to have something in the Farm Bill that would provide assistance and help for those who faced Mother Nature's winds. We had a disaster assistance program that worked extraordinarily well. It supplemented crop insurance, and it provided some degree of hope and help to those who were faced with difficulty. And in fact, in the 3 years that those programs were in effect, over 400,000 payments were made through the USDA, nearly $4 billion of assistance. Sadly, those programs expired last year and were not renewed by Congress this year. And so our livestock producers are faced with some very difficult challenges. We at USDA have attempted to try to provide help and assistance as best we can. The President called me into the West Wing, into the Oval Office several weeks ago and instructed me to do everything we could at USDA to provide help and assistance for all producers who are impacted by this drought. So we began a series of steps. We opened up some public lands through the Department of Interior and the Forest Service. We made available CRP land for hay grazing. We reduced the repayment responsibilities when CRP land is used. We created a lower interest on our emergency disaster loans. We worked with the SBA to expand credit opportunities beyond USDA. We're now working with the credit unions to do the same. We're working with the Department of Transportation to encourage them to encourage states to look at truck lengths and truck weights so that expenses can come down during the harvest so you don't have to make as many trips. Looking for a multitude of ways, greater flexibility with EQIP, helping people get through this very difficult time. But the reality is that our tools are somewhat limited. And the Rural Council that I chair is in the process of trying to determine other steps we can take. And I would anticipate and expect that next week we'll make another series of announcements, but our tools are limited. That's why it's so important, as we deal with this drought and the impacts of this drought, why it's so important that when the House of Representatives returns to work in September, that they focus initially and almost laser-like on passage of what I like to refer to as a food, farm, and jobs bill. That they get the work done, and that included in their Food, Farm, and Jobs Bill is a comprehensive disaster assistance program that provides help and relief to livestock producers and specialty crop producers and that complements and supplements the crop insurance activities that we have that will provide billions of dollars of assistance. No doubt there will be differences between the House and the Senate. That's why it's important for them to get their work done soon, so that they can get into a conference committee and can work out whatever policy differences they have. The Senate has passed its version in a bipartisan way. The House Agricultural Committee passed its version in a bipartisan way. And I'm confident that if the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader of the House would allow a vote on this bill, that there would be 218 people in that House that will understand the importance of rural America to that bill and to the country, and we get the job done. But we're going to need all of you to engage and assist us in encouraging our House members to get to work. You know, Lars, the best sign that I saw just before they left for recess, this big, huge sign outside the Congress that said, "Summer School for Congress, no recess." Apparently they didn't take that to heart, but there's still time. And it's going to be important, I think critically important, for rural America that this job get done. Because what we have going in rural America, notwithstanding this drought, is an extraordinary new opportunity, a set of opportunities, a pathway, I like to say, for rural prosperity that we haven't seen for some time. When I got this job, the president instructed me to try to diversify income opportunities and to try to create new ways of those who live, work, and raise their families in rural areas to be able to benefit from our natural resources and to be able to take the full advantage of our natural resources. He said, create a new pathway, create a new way of doing business in rural America. And so we set about doing that, and the first thing we did is the President's National Export Initiative said it's important that we continue to export, and we have. The last 3 years we've had record exports of agricultural production. The American brand of agriculture is well known around the world and sought after around the world. Even in this difficult year, we're still going to see a pretty strong export year. And we know that it doesn't just simply add opportunity for farm income, but it helps to support jobs here at home. Every $1 billion of agricultural exports supports 7,800 jobs. And so three record years obviously made a difference in terms of the economy. And the reason we did this was because we had a strategic framework, a focus, persistent and consistent with the President's National Export Initiative. We basically developed a strategic framework focused on the 20 to 25 countries where we had the greatest opportunities for exports, and we really hammered down. We had reverse trade shows and more trade shows and exchanges and things of that nature, all of which led to increased exports. And need to remind you and the rest of the country that agriculture is one of the bright spots in terms of trade because we have a trade surplus in agriculture, and last year our trade surplus was at record levels. So production agriculture and exports. And key to production agriculture is the continued willingness to invest in research so that we can continue to be the most productive farmers in the world. What's happened in my lifetime in terms of corn production, soybean production, wheat production is nothing short of amazing. Over a 300% increase in corn production, nearly 200% in soybean and wheat production, which has allowed us to consider lots of different ways in which we can use these crops. So we have to continue to invest in research so that we can continue to expand production, continue to lead the world. Production, agriculture, and exports, critically important. But we've got to complement that, and we have. You know, our farmers and ranchers are the greatest stewards of the land and water. They understand that their livelihood is linked to the capacity of that land to continue to produce and to have sufficient water to be able to do so. And so they have become conservation-minded. And what we have done in this administration is take it one step further, not just simply encourage more conservation. In fact, we have a record amount of acres enrolled in conservation programs in the last couple of years. But we've also seen the wisdom of linking that to outdoor recreational opportunities. You see, outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, biking, hiking, all the things that people do outdoors creates economic activity in rural areas. I mean, think about it. People come from cities and suburbs. They go hunting. They go fishing. They stay in a hotel. They eat at a restaurant. They buy supplies at the local hardware store. They stimulate the economy. So to the extent that you can expand conservation, link it to more habitat, better landscapes, you're encouraging outdoor recreational opportunities, which is why the president initiated the Great American Outdoors effort to try to reacquaint people around the country with the importance of our rural areas. And it's working. We had 166 million people visit our national forests. We have close to 200 million visitors to our national parks, most of which are located in rural areas. So it's important and necessary for us to continue to invest in conservation and to look for ways to encourage private investment in conservation, which is why at USDA we're working to create what we call ecosystem markets. The ability of a private sector industry who needs a conservation result to essentially pay farmers to produce that result. Let me give you an example. You've got a situation in Ohio where there's a power plant, or excuse me, a municipal wastewater plant that is confronted with having to do major improvements because of the condition of the water that they're treating. Millions of dollars of expense. Someone thought, well, maybe it'd be a better opportunity, a better plan, if we spent a little less money asking farmers to engage in conservation to avoid whatever it was that was getting in the water from getting in the water. And so millions of dollars of economic activity is being generated because you can quantify and verify and measure the effects and benefits of conservation. And so farmers are benefiting from this. The wastewater treatment facility is benefiting from this. And the customers of that wastewater treatment facility are benefiting with lower costs. Ecosystem markets, tremendous opportunity here for us to engage the private sector in helping to support conservation of our natural resources. Second strategy. Third strategy, local and regional food systems. This is now not just a quaint little idea. This is a multi-billion dollar opportunity. We've seen an extraordinary increase in farmers markets. We have a program called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food at USDA, where we're encouraging the development of a supply chain so that people who produce locally can sell locally. Encouraging schools and institutional buyers to have a sense of what is actually raised and grown in their area and see if you can establish sufficient quantities so that there is a reliable source from the local area. It keeps the wealth that's created in that area in the area. And we've seen a remarkable and dramatic increase in that type of activity. And so we're going to continue to focus on building out those supply chains, creating new diverse opportunities. And the great thing about this, this is one of the entryways for young people to get back into farming. Because not everyone can afford to buy 500 acres here in Nebraska or in Iowa or someplace else. But they can potentially be able to, through the Beginning Farmer Program, to buy 5 or 10 acres and create a community support agricultural activity or support farmers markets in the area, and creating diversified income opportunities. And we've actually seen about 100,000 new entrepreneurial opportunities created in rural areas because of this local and regional food system movement. A compliment. And then the final cornerstone of this new pathway to prosperity is the bio-based economy, of which you are central. It began with the discussion of biofuel, but it's now expanded far beyond that. We're now creatively and innovatively thinking in this country how we can use every aspect of a crop, every aspect of plants, every aspect of livestock waste in a way in which we can produce chemicals and fabrics and fibers and polymers. I was in Michigan last week. Shoot, it was early this week, I guess. I've forgotten where I started my week. I was in Michigan this week. It was Ohio last week. Rubber tires made from soybeans. Ford Motor Company, every single car that's produced in North America, every single car, the seats in every single car and truck produced in North America, soybean-based. The rubber trim in doorways and windows, bio-based. Saw solvents and dandelion stems in Ohio being used to produce rubber and hog waste being used to produce asphalt. There is unlimited opportunity here. 3,100 companies today, employing 100,000 folks, 25,000 products, including the fuel that you all produce. 25,000 opportunities to take waste product, crop residue, plant material, and create something extraordinarily valuable. And that's why the president instructed me to make the federal government a supporter of this new industry. You know, we buy a lot of stuff in the federal government. We buy a lot of supplies, a lot of cleaners, a lot of lubricants, a lot of clothing. And the president instructed us to increase and to double the number of products that federal agencies can purchase that are bio-based. So we've added 2,300 new products, 12 new lines. And our goal is to add 9,000 new products so that we encourage the Department of Defense and the USDA and the Health and Human Services and the Justice Department and Corrections to purchase bio-based products. We've begun a process of labeling so that consumers going into stores will know when they see the USDA bio-based label that it's something that's helping to create economic activity. It's an amazing new opportunity not just to revive the rural economy, but to reshape the entire American economy, because it continues to reduce our reliance on outside influences on where our oil and petroleum comes from, something that you're particularly familiar with. And it started with you. It started with this notion that we could help the country by diversifying our fuel supply, that we could take corn and crop residue and soybeans and create new fuel opportunities. And we're going one step further. We're doing something that's never been done before in the history of the federal government. We have three federal agencies cooperating together to help to create a new industry, a drop-in aviation fuel industry. The Department of the Navy wants 50% of its fuel needs to be met through biofuels. 50%. It's a national security imperative from their perspective. They're not really excited about the notion that our defense is dependent on someone else's oil. And so they're encouraging the development of this drop-in aviation and marine fuel from a variety of non-food feedstocks that can create new opportunities throughout rural America. Just several weeks ago in the Pacific Theater, a two-day exercise by the Great Green Fleet, every plane, every helicopter, every ship in that two-day exercise used biofuel. Every aspect of it was fueled by biofuel. Consider the possibilities of this new industry and the amazing employment opportunities and innovations that will occur. So this administration is four square behind a bio-based economy. And that brings us to the discussion of the day, which is the importance of the biofuel industry. Now, I'm going to repeat the benefits of this industry, not because I don't believe you know them, but there may be a few folks here reporting on this who may not fully appreciate it, so we'll do a little education tool here. First of all, it is important, as I've said, to diversify where our fuel and energy comes from so that we're not overly dependent on any one aspect. And the biofuel industry and the renewable fuel industry has basically created this opportunity for us to diversify. It is a job creator. Nearly 400,000 jobs, directly or indirectly, connected to this industry. People build plants, maintain plants, fix plants, repair plants, truck product, pump product, create the distribution systems and the dispensing systems. All of those are jobs in the economy. 400,000 supported. It provides the consumer choice and the opportunity to go to a gas station and no doubt, no question, pay less than they would otherwise pay. Were it not for the biofuel industry, there is no question that gas prices would be even higher today than they are. Now, you can pick a study. There's several of them. But the lowest I've seen is 25 cents a gallon. The highest I've seen is $1.37 a gallon, difference in terms of cost at the pump. So it's saving the American consumer millions of dollars. And it's reducing our reliance on foreign oil. In just the last 3 years, we've gone from importing 62% of our oil down to 45%. We're helping to create new opportunities in the Midwest of the country as opposed to the Middle East and other parts of the world. So whether it's diversifying our fuel supply from a national security perspective, helping to create jobs, giving consumers choice and savings, developing new income sources for farmers, or reducing our reliance on foreign oil, when you take a look at the total package, this is an industry that is worth supporting, which is why the President is supporting the Renewable Fuel Standard. And it's why I'm supporting the Renewable Fuel Standard. Now, there are some folks who don't see it this way. And there's some folks who are suggesting that we need to undermine the standard, who don't think this industry is as important as I see it and as you see it. And they are using a variety of different strategies to raise issues and questions. Now, I recognize that it's Lisa Jackson's responsibility to deal with requests for waivers or adjustments to the renewable fuel standard, and I don't want to suggest that I'm doing her job or that she needs me to help her do her job. But I think it is important and Lars, you mentioned this, to emphasize that the market responds. The market reacts. The market pays attention. And we're already seeing that. Livestock producers are paying attention, so they're reducing their herds. The export markets are paying attention, so we have a bit more competition than we've had in the last couple of years. And the ethanol industry is paying attention. You all know that production in many areas of the country, in many facilities, is down. Some cases 10%, some cases 20%. I've heard some 30%, and some plants have shut down for a period of time. You're paying attention to the market. You're allowing the market to respond and react as it should. And I think it's important to emphasize that, that the market is indeed responding and reacting to what we see. Now, we don't really know what the yields will be. We can make projections, we can make estimates, we can make guesses. We don't know and won't know until the crop is, in fact, harvested. But what we do know is that the market is already responding to the reality of this drought. We also know that built into the renewable fuel standard process is flexibility. It's not as if this process was created without any understanding that agriculture is risky, that there's a chance that you may have a drought, or that you may have a storm, or you may have a pest or disease that creates problems with the crop. And so built into the system was the capacity to use credits in lieu of. And these credits have been accumulated over a period of time and are roughly equivalent, I'm told, to a billion or 2 gallons of ethanol. And so the industry has the capacity to respond. So the market's responding. The industry has the capacity to respond as well. That needs to be taken into consideration. And then the question is, what would the impact be? How significant would it be in terms of price? And there are some studies that would indicate that the significance in the scheme of things is not as great as maybe some people had anticipated. So the standard for the waiver is pretty high. You got to show significant economic harm in a region. You got to take all the factors into consideration. But I think it is important to point out that the market is responding and the system has flexibility in it. That's where you all come in. See, you think I've got a job. I'm here to tell you you've got the job. I think it's important for us to understand that this is a concerted, organized, well-financed, and strategically thought-out campaign against this industry. You need to recognize that. And you need to respond. Because the benefits of this industry are too important to sacrifice. This isn't just about your individual economic interest. This is about the 400,000 people whose jobs are dependent on us doing a good job of educating the country about the importance of this industry. This isn't just about what it may mean to your bottom line. It's about whether or not this country can, in fact, move towards economic and energy security because we have diversification and we're not overly dependent on some other part of the world. This is a big deal, and it's important for the industry, for the ethanol industry, for the biofuel industry, for the renewable fuel industry to be engaged. And it's not enough simply to write a letter to a congressman. And it's not enough to have a press conference in Washington, D.C. What is important is that you folks, the people that are leaders in your community, engage your community. Going to a gas station, a convenience store, and pointing out that all your friends and neighbors in your community are indeed paying less for their gas because you and others like you are creating this industry. It isn't just about you writing your member of Congress or even going to a town hall meeting in the recess and encouraging passage of a food, farm, and jobs bill that contains a strong commitment to the energy title It's more than that. It's engaging your state and local leaders to do the same. There are members of Congress who have publicly displayed their support for the opposition. There needs to be a corresponding set of politicians who stand up and say, well, wait a second, this is important to the country. This is a job creator. This is giving consumers choice. There's flexibility in the system. The market's responding. You've got governors and state legislative leaders that need to be engaged in this, and you need to engage them and encourage their involvement. You need to make sure that the country understands the facts. You know, one of the things that's happening in this drought is I get these calls from my friends in the media, and they say, food prices are going up. Report, world food prices are going up. So wait a second. You've got to distinguish between food and commodity prices. So what do you mean? So what's being reported is that corn prices are up, or wheat prices are up, or rice prices are up. That doesn't necessarily always translate in this country to food prices going up equally. If corn goes up a dollar, it doesn't mean that everything in the grocery store is going up a buck. Because it's an opportunity to point out to folks that farmers only get 14 cents of every food dollar that goes through a grocery store and a restaurant. 14 cents. So you can see commodity prices dramatically increase. And the impact on food prices is not as significant. We estimate food inflation next year to be somewhere between 3 and 4%. Historically, it's 3%. Not much difference. And if you try to quantify what this drought may impact and how it may impact food prices, we estimate maybe 0.5%, at most 1%. And then say, why am I seeing food prices increasing now? Well, it's not because of the drought. You got to ask the question, who's getting the other 86 cents? Ever thought about that? Who's getting the other 86 cents? Well, it's people who truck, ship, process, package, shell, refrigerate, store. What do all those people have in common? They use energy. Oil prices go up. What happens to all the folks getting that other 86 cents? Ever thought about that? Ever talk to your friends and neighbors about that? Ever talk to your state legislators and governors about that? Ever convey that to your members of Congress? Folks, this is an education responsibility we have. We also have to have a responsibility to point out that when ethanol is produced, it isn't just ethanol that's produced. A third of what goes in that comes out as livestock feed. In addition to other co-products that creates new economic opportunity and expands the bio-based economy. You've got to educate. You've got to advocate. You've got to be engaged. You just can't simply be upset or angry or frustrated. You've got to get in the game because the other side is clearly in the game. And I'm confident if we get in the game and we communicate effectively, people will see, this is good for the country. We have diversification. It's good for job growth. It's good for income production in rural areas. You need to ask folks, why all of a sudden in the last couple of years have we seen record farm income? Have we seen unemployment going down in rural areas at a faster rate? Why are we seeing rural manufacturing come back for the first time in two decades? Why is that? It's because we got a framework for rebuilding the rural economy. I'm going to close with this and then I'll take questions. As important as all of this is that I've just talked about, there's one other thing that's really important to me and to you and to this country about why you need to be engaged and why we need to create an understanding of what's going on in rural America and the momentum that we're building and the need for a food, farm, and jobs bill that helps support that momentum. It has to do with the value system that's inherent, that's rooted in those rural communities. The statistic I say to every audience I speak to, 16% of America lives in rural America. Nearly 40% of the military comes from rural America. Why is that? I use my nephew as an example, Sam Bell. Sam was a B student at Mount Pleasant High School. B student. I think if Sam worked a little harder, he could have been an A student. He was a B student. Sam's parents are well off. Sam could have gone to Iowa State or University of Iowa or Northern Iowa or virtually any public university or college in the country. He didn't do that. He chose to go in the Marine Corps. He chose, instead of a leadership opportunity he was given, to go in the infantry. And he found himself this year spending time in Afghanistan, 20 years old, as an explosive expert. Why would somebody like Sam Bell pass up an opportunity to go to college for an opportunity to go into a place that is pretty doggone dangerous? It's because Sam and people like Sam grow up in rural towns, surrounded by farmland. And the people who work that land and who live in those communities and who go to school with people like Sam and who teach people like Sam and who go to church with people like Sam basically instill in that entire community a basic understanding about the land, which is you can't keep taking from the land. There's not a farmer in this audience that doesn't do something to replenish the land. Otherwise, it stops giving to you. You understand that something worth having is something worth investing in and caring. And these kids grow up understanding that if there's something important, you got to give something back to it. And you got a country that gives you all these freedoms, all these liberties, this extraordinary prosperity, even in the most difficult of times. A nation that's food secure, never has to worry about where its next meal's coming from. Extraordinary. Incredible country. Somebody's got to give back to it. You teach kids to give back. That's why this is important. The preservation of that value system. So folks, please leave this conference understanding how significant this is, how important you are, and how incredibly important your voice is. And your advocacy. Because if you're silent, if you're on the sidelines, others will take advantage of that. And not only will rural America be worse off for it, but that value system won't be as strong, won't be as supported. And that impacts and affects all of us. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you.